Tonight we have a special guest on the show. We have Lee Greenwood. And Lee, why is this issue important to you?
Well, for one thing, among others, it's just wrong. We are a nation of, we're a great nation of learned people, and it is barbaric to have such a law on the books. Secondly, well, maybe ranked up there first, my son and my family have been a victim of the death penalty. My son, Joseph Nichols, was executed on March 7th, 2007, just a little bit over a year ago. It's a devastating thing. He was first convicted under the law of parties. And people are more inclined not to, even those that believe in the death penalty, are not inclined to vote for death if a person is not the actual killer. And in this case, Joseph was not. Of course, Texas practicing the law of parties. Joseph was tried under the law of parties, convicted, and in the punishment phase, the jury said that they could not either send him to prison for the rest of his life nor give him the death penalty, as he was not the shooter. The DA in Houston, Texas, Harris County, of course, decided to try him again. This time they tried him as the actual killer.
So they didn't have any compunction about altering the facts of the case, right?
No, they did not. As a matter of fact, they took evidence that they were adamant about, which showed him not to be the killer, and turned around and used it against him and said, well, on second thought, he is the killer. And they already had in custody a young man that had confessed to killing them, always did until he was executed in 1995.
So they executed both of them?
Yes, they did.
And when you say law of parties, the audience needs to understand that in Texas law, that if you're a participant in an event and a capital offense occurs as a result of that event, you can be charged equally with the perpetrator. And that has long been standing. But recently, we had the first, that I know of, clemency issued under the law of parties in a more recent case.
That's true. You really don't have to be a participant. In Joseph's case, he had been present, but was not present when the person was killed. So you have to have been a party maybe in the beginning of the action, but not necessarily completely throughout the action.
Lee, you've been living with this now a little over a year. Keep you awake at night?
Not anymore. For the 25 years that Joseph was on death row, he went to death row at age 21. He was arrested at age 19. A month or so after his birthday, when he was executed, he was 45 years old. Now, I was sleepless many of those nights because you wonder if there is something that you're not doing that you should be doing. And after Joseph was executed, he said, Mom, you know, promise me one thing, that if this system takes me down, and he felt sure that they would, that just let me be a part when it's abolished. So I carry on fighting, protesting, doing radio shows like this, and talking to other families to get them to realize the most important thing you must do is let the person know that you are with them, that you're behind them. It's not easy as a mother. It's not easy for any part of the family. But mothers know that if they falter or if they are not able to stand, the rest of the family can't stand either. And in my case, I had four of the children. So you remain strong for them, and then at night you have a five-minute breakdown.
What do you tell the kids?
In our case, we tell the children the truth, and they were young adults when Joseph went to prison. Joseph is my third child. He's my middle child. We always promised him that we would let him know the things that were going on in the family, whether they were good or bad. We always kept him informed. And moreover, he was the orchestrator of his own life while he was in prison. He made the decisions. I've never done anything unless I spoke to him about it. If it was a radio show, if it was talking to people, I went and asked him. After all, he was the most important person in this scenario, not the rest of us. He was the one that had to stay at the prison after we visited him and left. So he was living it. All we needed to do was stand behind him. And he was a very, very strong person.
Our guest, Lee Greenwood, who's joined us here in the studio to talk about her experiences as we continue the coverage of the execution of Larry Davis. Could I get you to swing the microphone over to Jim? Jim, before we got on the air, you speculated or you wondered on how Larry got from Dallas. Apparently he was a Dallas boy.
Yeah, apparently from this, he was reared around the Dallas area, and from what I've read, he was apparently had the typical thing you often see on kiddos on death row, a bad childhood. Not a bad childhood. He was reared apparently in a series of church homes and somehow ended up, of all horrible places to be, Amarillo, Texas. I don't know how he got from Dallas to Amarillo, but that's a bad place to go. I know I'm from Amarillo, so I'm real familiar with it.
Well, Lee's from Baytown, and I'm from Cloverleaf. So we've all got a similar problem here. But Larry went wound up in Amarillo. Now, is his whole crime career out of Amarillo?
Everything, every conviction I can find came out of Amarillo, except... And there was a lot of vagueness on this. Apparently, there was a pending death penalty case that had been identified in a robbery murder in Dallas, but was not tried on it. They decided not to try it after he got the death penalty in Amarillo. But as far as going to the penitentiary, he went a couple of times for kind of what we would call kind of minor things of theft and some having a prohibited weapon. I think the maximum sentence he ever got was like 4 years. On all of them, a couple of times, out of Amarillo.
Reading the story, and of course I read the story, Jim reads it from the experience of being an experienced criminal lawyer and having dealt with these issues for a good many years. I read it from the experience of being convict, and reading this experience in my eyes, looked like he went to prison for relatively minor stuff, short sentence stuff.
Yeah.
And got caught up in that culture, and his not ever having a family mean that he was especially vulnerable to gangs and other surrogates for families that crop up in prison. And he bought the whole banana. He bought the idea of blood in, blood out, and all of that. And so prison actually may have been a predicate to his more serious criminal past. By the time he gets to this incident, it's a group of gangsters that are committing a robbery of an individual. And according to the information put out by the Attorney General's office, they try to paint Larry as kind of a Charlie Manson character. But there was actually a heavier gangster there. Ray Ray guy was a heavier gangster. But he, Ray Ray, having more experience than Larry, knew how the system worked, and so he cooperated with the prosecutor just enough to get himself a 50-year sentence.
You know, I've often wondered something that has always been curious about this. You know, we have no hesitation in products liability case to sue folks when they put something dangerous out. I've often wondered why families of victims don't sue TDC, because literally this is one of those cases, frankly, where TDC pretty well made, or at least the way the systems mm-hmm. may set up, like you said, pretty well guaranteed that somebody's going to get harmed by it. And it seems to me that one of the things that we should talk about a whole lot with our prison system is hopefully have a better product when they come out if they went in. For example, if a hospital operated like TDC and people are more diseased and more dangerous when they come out of the hospital, they'd close it down in a heartbeat. And in a case like this, you got a kid that never had, obviously, he was raised in a series of church homes, like you're right, had no family connections, gets obviously tied up with gangs and TDC, mm-hmm. and there was even talk in this about...
Oh, this whole thing dealt with the tattoo of teardrop under their eye that they had to earn with blood. Somebody else did.
Yeah. According to this, Ray Ray, there were two brothers involved that kind of set the killing up, and they were trying to get money to get it buy a tattoo to get a teardrop put on their eyes on a gang deal, like the Crips mm-hmm. gang deal.
Sure.
And that was, they were the ones behind the robbery. And it was a continuation of literally what we as taxpayers paid for him to learn in prison.
That's right.
And it seems to me that I've often wondered again why this would be a good products liability case, why somebody hasn't sued the state for turning, for making people like this. And literally, this is pretty much what happened. I think you hit the nail on the head.
It's not really unpredictable because one of the other activities that I do in conjunction with the prison show is I work with a program called GRAD, which is the gang rejection activities and development program inside prison. And that's booming business because you get folks in gangs, and of course, the image, if you watch television, the news channels that do the prison stuff, you get the impression that gangs are tough guys hanging together. And that's not entirely accurate. Gangs are basically cowards manipulating weak people. The head of the gang somehow manages to have clean hands while the people that they manipulate do the dirty work inside prison and sometimes outside prison. But it's not tough guys hanging together. It's cowards manipulating weak people. But you get who's vulnerable to gang seduction is are those people who do not have stable family conditions on the outside, that have no families like Lee Greenwood to be here for them when they get out. Folks that have families and connections generally do not wind up in gangs. But the people that that don't have family connections are in search of a family, and the gang has the charade of a family involved. But that's prison culture.
I don't know if you might have, I thought I sent it to you, but about a month and a half ago, the New York Times Magazine had a big article about gang intervention in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
They had a program in which they had ex-members of gangbangers who actually ran a program that went into the neighborhood and intervened. And they were talking about the marvelous success they had with having former gang members that the city actually hired and paid a salary to
mm-hmm.
that went into areas that were infested with gangs and tried to build up that family relationship and have some type of bonding with somebody that had had a similar gang experience but had, you know, gotten their lives straightened out. And there was a real extensive article on the success they were having in Chicago about intervening, not just paroling somebody out and dumping them, but actually intervening with people like this kiddo here, Larry Davis. Had he might have had that intervention very well, could have prevented a murder had that occurred.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the thing about it is I was down doing a recovery meeting in the grad program the other day, and there's this great big old fellow sitting next to me. I mean, big fellow. I mean, this guy weighed damn near 300 pounds and didn't have enough excess body fat to pinch. A pretty scary guy in prison.
Sounds like it.
And so he's sitting next to me, and we go through to it. And he was really struggling, trying to be a part of the discussion in a recovery meeting. I was very impressed with this guy's sincerity. Well, I get through the meeting, and I come home, and I turn on the television. And they're on MSNBC. There's this guy. Same one. And the film is about his rejecting the gangs when he was the commander of the Texas Syndicate. And I thought, oh my gosh. And apparently that had happened long enough ago that they had a documentary about it, and here he was just starting the grad program. So there's like a 2 or 3 year delay from when you say you're going to reject the gangs before you get into the grad program. And during that period of time, they went down and interviewed him and made a documentary out of it. When he rejected the gangs, he went out in that yard alone to let them take it out on him. He was stabbed 51 times.
My gosh.
He left the yard with a screwdriver sticking out of the back of his head. He was helped off the yard by a female guard who was in the documentary. And she said, the only thing he told me is that I can't be seen falling on this yard. You have to get me to help me get to the building so I can fall. And she propped him up. But that was the sincerity with which he rejected that whole gang thing. And to me, that was as important as Moses in his burning bush or St. Paul on the road to Jericho. I mean, that he had an epiphany of some kind, and he was willing to pay the price that it cost him to get out of that gang. Apparently, Larry Davis didn't pay that price. He didn't have that epiphany. Apparently, he was caught up in something larger than himself, and right as we speak, they're going through a very slow, careful, ritual killing of Larry Davis. They have strapped him into the gurney before anyone came in. The media has gone in. The witnesses for the victim, if they are there, are gathered around. They have needles in his arms and tubes attached to those needles. And the warden is standing there next to the telephone just in case there's a call from the clemency department of the governor's office. And if that doesn't happen, the warden will give a hand signal and they will start the chemical flow. But before we got here, we went through other rituals. Jim, what is the appellate process for someone when they're convicted of a capital crime?
Okay, first off, when you're convicted of a capital murder, you go to appeal directly to the Court of Criminal Appeals, which is a 9-court judge in Austin. And that's called a direct appeal to them. And the time frame from the trial itself till the direct appeal is probably a year and a half to 2 years, about that length of time. And our Court of Criminal Appeals has not been very gracious about capital murder cases. They've been pretty kind of outlandish, and usually they affirm the conviction. After the conviction is affirmed, then there's a writ process that you go from back to the convicting court to file what we call a state writ. And that happened in this case, and the state writ was denied. And then at that point, you apply for certiorari to the United States Supreme Court, and usually in cases like that, they deny. Then what your option is at that point is to go back to what they call a post-conviction writ procedure in federal court. Mm-hmm. And they did that here. And his federal writ was denied, and then in Fifth Circuit, they gave him what they call a certificate of appealability, and the Fifth Circuit turned down his writ. And then there were no further appeals made. This is what you call a fast track. From the time of trial to the death sentence has been about 9 years. About a fast track because this is, like I say, very unusual. You had a direct appeal affirmed, mm-hmm. state writ denied, and a federal writ denied, and Fifth Circuit affirming, and that's it. Yeah, so what you call a very fast track on somebody being executed.
And then tonight there was an application for clemency made in this case. We know that happened in this case.
Well, it was denied. You see, they requested Tuesday the Board of Pardons and Parole send a letter to Potter County, and they denied the. They asked to have the sentence commuted to life, and then they asked that he get a 180-day stay, and both of those were denied Tuesday.
Okay, let's have put Gloria on. Gloria, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What's happened?
Well, Michael Graciuk from the Associated Press and some other well-dressed people and Michelle Lyons have come out. So the execution has taken place. Larry Davis is dead, and 400 and what are we at? 8 or 9 people have been executed.
Okay.
Oh, Jesus. I can't ever remember being up here when the person being executed didn't at least have a spiritual advisor, if not, you know, it's not usually the mama, but a dad, a brother, sister, wife. But I don't believe anybody went in with this man.
It was all alone, except for witnesses for the victim, if they came.
If they came. Now, you know, Amarillo's a long way away.
Yeah.
Quite possibly... nobody was in there but the media. I guess I'll find out in a few.
Well, and our discussing Larry didn't have much family. He was raised in church schools.
That's right.
And probably the gang that he was involved in was a desperate search for a family. It didn't work out for him.
Exactly. One of the interesting things I found out about him is while somebody's walking out with his two onion sacks full of property, I found out that he was an artist. In fact, I found online a beautiful drawing that he had done of Dr. King. But one of my friends on death row wrote and told me that he was a quiet guy. His nickname was Artist. He said most of us didn't even know his name. And being so far away from his family, who knows? I know he was born in Dallas, but raised in Amarillo.
Uh-huh. We worried about how he got from Dallas to Amarillo because his criminal history is in Amarillo, but his birthplace is Dallas. But you see, they've come out with two orange sacks of material. They came out with two orange sacks of his property.
Yeah, and the I guess it's the Texas Rangers with their cowboy hats have come out, and a few other men in suits, and the guy with the property put it in the back of his pickup, and I guess he's heading over to the funeral home. I have a feeling that's the doctor, you sorry SOB.
And if his family does not claim his body, he will be buried in the Joe Bird Cemetery.
In the morning, 8 o'clock.
At 8 o'clock on Peckerwood Hill, there
right.
In North Huntsville.
Now, one of the women out here, who's here with her husband and her granddaughter, said that they went to the cemetery and didn't see a new grave that had been dug. But I guess, you know, who knows. Excuse me, sir. Do you know if Davis's family is here? Do you know if he's going to be buried at the prison cemetery? Okay. Well, the Texas Ranger doesn't know much.
Okay. But you're not getting much information out of guys in uniform these days. Okay, Gloria.
All right. Well, thank y'all for doing the good work.
Give love on behalf of the prison show to the other folks there.
I will. Okay.
Bye-bye. And that was, again, Gloria Rubeck. She is on the point. Bodies in Texas are property. And so when someone is executed, there is, of course, a body. And that body, under Texas law, belongs to someone. If they don't want it, the prison system, via contract with Huntsville Funeral Home, puts it in a body bag according to the minimum requirements of the Texas mortuary law. And they bury them in a 6-foot grave in Peckerwood Hill, which is the Joe Bird Cemetery for indigent inmates in Huntsville, Texas. If you go up there, wind your way through Sam Houston University, and the road that goes right by the Gopher Bowl, which is kind of an underground, below-surface football stadium, just keep on going, and an enormous cemetery, stark, enormous territory, will loom to your immediate right. I've been out there many times in documentary about work on the prison show. We have gone through Joe Bird Cemetery, Picklewood Hill, and took a look at those graves, and they show up in a lot of documentary films. We have another guest joining us, Nancy Bailey, who is a death penalty coordinator for Amnesty International's Houston chapter. Nancy, are you there?
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
How you doing?
Well, I mean, we lost another round. They have apparently executed Larry Davis a few minutes ago.
Now, I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sitting in front of the computer and nothing's come out on it yet.
Well, you may as well, as you talk to us, post that for friends in your circles. Because execution watch, you can listen to us on your computer by going to kpft.org and searching out the HD2 channel. I suspect most of the people listening are listening to us over the computer, although there are a few HD radios out there, and they may be tuned in. And my point is that you're an activist on this issue.
Yes, I am.
Tell us about that.
I'm also a member of Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty.
Well, tell us about that. What is being done and what should be being done and what can be done?
That's a very difficult question, and we're still trying to find the answers. But we feel that by educating the public about the realities of the death penalty, that public opinion is slowly turning around and realizing that the death penalty is not good public policy.
Well, do you think that the effort is helped by the exoneration?
I think
so many cases.
Exonerations have had a big impact. I think there's a certain segment of society that this has been the issue that has made them stop and look. There are other people that are more into the morality issue, but there are others that really thought it was a good thing to do from a crime deterrent standpoint that never considered that innocent people might have been convicted and even executed.
Well, what's going on in Dallas is interesting because Henry Wade has gone on to a greater reward or punishment, such as the case may be, and left behind him a trail that is now coming to light of wrongfully convicted people, both in execution cases and in very serious criminal punishment cases.
That's right.
And but one of the things that can be said about Henry Wade is that he saved every shred of evidence so that now the DNA test can explore those facts again, whereas Johnny Holmes and the recently removed Chuck Rosenthal seem to go out of their way to destroy the evidence as quickly as possible.
They certainly didn't help preserve it, did they?
No, they didn't, and I don't know why we would think that the system worked any better in Harris County than it did in Dallas County.
I don't think there's any reason to believe that at all.
Well, Larry Davis, the person that was executed tonight, Jim Skelton brought up an interesting point earlier that someone ought to sue the prison system because he went in for relatively minor offenses and seemed to become hardened prison gangster and got out, and that membership in prison gangs then may have predicated his subsequent crimes of violence.
I think that's a very good point. There's a lot of people who go into the prison system and come out not better than when they went in. It's not always the case, but it does frequently happen. And as you say, this particular crime was a gang-related crime related to an initiation into a gang. And, you know, if we could use the resources that are currently being used to keep the death penalty going, we could do a lot more toward perhaps intervening in gang participation, which is what really brings a lot of young people into the area of crime.
Well, Nancy, you've been in this work a while, haven't you?
In a long time. It's been 10 to 12 years.
I think it's interesting that the average time a person spends on death row is about 10 and a half years.
Yeah, but that average is going to get smaller and smaller because some of the people that are being executed now are ones that have been there for 20 years or more that were convicted under a law that gave them more time to and more avenues for appeal. Whereas if you're convicted now, your appeals are far more limited, and the likelihood is that you're going to die, even with appeals, in less than 7 years.
Lee, if you give that microphone a little closer to Lee, because I've got Lee Greenwood in with me, and Lee lost a son to Texas death row. I'm looking over the schedule here of the next 14 people who are scheduled to be executed. And the two cases from 1975, one case from 1978, and the rest of them are older cases than that. The shortest time for anybody to be executed was Joe Gonzalez. And Joe was he's from Potter County. They executed him in 248 days. It was less than a year after his conviction. And he was executed in September of 96. And Stephen Renfro from Harrison County was executed in 257 days. And that was, he was executed in 1998. The longest period of time was Excel White from Collin County. He served over 24 years before being executed. And I don't know why they call it served. He was locked up on death row for more than 24 years. And Sammy Felder from Harris County was there for 23 years. And the age of those folks executed, the average is 39. And the youngest people to be executed were both 24. They're from Jay Pinkerton and Jesse De La Rosa. I knew Jesse De La Rosa from Bexar County. And Toronto Patterson from Dallas County. All three of those were 24. But, you know, studying, we almost go through rituals of keeping these statistics. And that seems macabre to me. Does anything about that strike you as macabre, Nancy?
Are you asking me or
yes,
Lee?
Both of you. But all of this, it just makes it more ritualized. It's almost like this is a religious ceremonial thing.
True. But there's a, they do try to cloak it in an air of sanctity that's really pretty, I hate to say amusing, that's not the right word.
It's gruesome.
Ridiculous to think about the sanctity that they seem to think that they're operating within.
Do you have any speculation as to why Texas does more of it than anybody else?
No, other than that there's very little discretion used by a good many of our prosecutors as far as trying to decide which are the most deserving of seeking the death penalty. I believe that, in Harris County, the policy was pretty much, if it was death qualified, if they were going to seek the death penalty, if it filled the criteria of two or more victims in the same transaction or any kind of underlying felony that they could possibly attach to it, that they're going to seek the death penalty in every case, not on just the worst of the worst. But I think that trend is reversing already.
Well, we've had a couple of juries that just didn't do it lately.
In spite of having the death penalty stopped, that's what really is telling, that even when they have sought the death penalty and had a death-qualified jury, that they have not found or not assessed the death penalty. And that's really a step in the right direction.
And the accused didn't even prove to be rich.
Right.
You know, in Texas, it's always said that you're guilty until proven rich, and it's certainly a different. There's unquestionably a different quality of defense. Although, you know, I know some court-appointed lawyers that just sweat blood. Of course, they lose money on this.
Right. In most cases, if there's a diligent defense, they do lose money.
But these, and there are lawyers that are in this business and support themselves through foundation grants and other things because they know they're going to lose their income in case after case after case. Because I've had lawyers call me say how much you can charge for expert witness in a case where I'm talking about prison conditions or something of that nature. And I can't really charge those people anything because I know that a lawyer's taking down the cuff. So I say, feed me. Make them take me to dinner and to lunch and maybe pay my way into a conference somewhere. But there are some wonderful people that are not being well paid that work their professional butts off.
That's true.
Trying to defend people. And, of course, the popular knowledge is, oh, my God, if you don't pay for it, they're not worth anything. And I just don't believe that because I know too many people that are not getting paid for it and doing the best they can on the very, very limited budget that a court-appointed attorney is allowed. That brings up the whole issue of a public defender system.
I was sitting here thinking about that, wondering if you were going to raise that issue.
Well, what do you think about it?
I think it would be really a good move. Not only would they have a more of a quality, better quality of representation, certainly not influenced by being appointed by judges who might not appoint them again, but there would be the ability to pool work and to pool investigative resources and get a lot more out of the money spent than the way that it's currently being done. I think it would be a wonderful thing, and I hope everybody will do what they can to speak to the city council or whoever it is that's supposed to have influence on whether
it's the county commissioner's court, and of course the state legislature, because there are a couple of senators involved in that advocacy, and it's easy to find out who they are. In Houston, Rodney Ellis is that.
Rodney Ellis is spearheading it.
A priority for him, and of course John Whitmire, who is himself a criminal defense lawyer, who sees the value in all of that. Nancy, before I let you go, how do people get in touch with you, either under the Coalition Against the Death Penalty or Amnesty International Houston Chaverty? If you got emails or, a website?
I'll just write off. I think it's easier for me to think of my personal email than to come up with, I think it's, I have a TCADP address, but better to say nlbailey@earthlink.net.
nlbailey, B-A-I.
L-E-Y.
L-E-Y at.
At earthlink.net.
Earthlink.net.
That's N-L as in Nancy Laura. And I don't mind giving you my phone number if you want to put it on the phone, on the radio.
Well, I've got it here.
Oh, that's right, you have.
I've got everything. We can get in touch with you, and we will be back in touch with you, because every time Texas killed somebody, we will be here for an hour at 6 o'clock on KPFT HD2 channel.
I don't mind you giving it on the air as a contact number, though.
Well, I don't expect there are throngs of people listening, but the archives will pick up a few more. Okay. That telephone number, you want to give me your home number?
Yeah, that's fine.
Is 281-933-4925. That's area code 281-933-4925. Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Could I throw in a plug for the TCADP website?
Please.
That's TCADP.org.
That's Coalition Against the Death Penalty.
TCADP.org.
TCADP.org.
And then Amnesty International 23. I can't come up with a link, but if you Google
Amnesty International
23, it will take you into the local website for the Houston chapter of Amnesty International, and it has a death penalty section in that website.
Thank you, ma'am.
Well, it's good to talk to you.
And we'll talk to you later, Nancy.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Nancy Begley of Amnesty International and Texas or Coalition Against Death Penalty. Lee, all right, we've spent an hour here talking about somebody else's death. And do you feel encouraged?
I believe that a public defender's office would be well for Houston.
Who represented your son?
The last, we went through three different sets of attorneys. The last group of attorneys was Bracewell and Giuliani.
Mm-hmm. And I know how that works. Bracewell and Giuliani is a law firm, a well-to-do law firm in Houston.
Yes.
They do a certain amount of public service work.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got good lawyers, and that was in part of the appellate work.
Yes.
Yeah.
But first, before we... Coupled with getting a public defender's office, we need to see that the DA's office is cleaned up first.
Sure. And that's
a
political
process. That's right. You can have a good public defender system in place, but if you have a DA's office or a police department that manufactures or withholds evidence, you're still fighting an uphill battle. Houston is notorious for that.
And that brings up the issue that there's here enough work for all of us.
Yes, there is.
On both sides of this microphone, we in here are going to provide the best leadership we can with communities over which we have influence. But you out there need to know who you're voting for and have some reason to vote for them. You know, it's the trouble of it is you go into a polling place and you don't recognize all those judges down there. So you look for a name that's familiar. What if you know it from a scandal? Is your memory so good that you know why you know this person's name?
But, you know, after we voted someone in office, we have to follow them and be sure that they do what they say that they're going to do. Hold them accountable. Because after all, we should be able to, just as we put them in office, take them out, vote them out of office. And I think that we will get better results. Now, we need more citizens fighting for the cause also.
Mm-hmm.
There's another organization locally, and that's the Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement.
Mm-hmm.
We meet on Tuesday nights at Shape Center at 7 p.m. If there's an execution, the meeting is held on Wednesday night. And Gloria Rubeck heads up that, is one of the founders
and
of that.
And she's on the picket line in Huntsville tonight.
Yes, she is. I believe, and I've always believed, that it takes two factions. It takes those that are working with legislative issues, and it takes those out on the street with signs and in protesting. It takes both factions.
Matter of fact, there's a lot of good stuff going on at Shape Community Center. Deloitte's a little stable over there. He's got a lot of stuff going on. He's got a couple of locations. He's got a location on White Oak.
Live Oak.
And he's got a location over on Alameda.
Mm-hmm.
Shape Community Center is its own website. Look it up, see what's going on. If you get involved, I believe that there's really only one picket line.
Okay.
I mean, civil rights movement, equal rights movement, lesbian gay movement, women's equality, capital punishment, prison reform. There's only one long picket line. Just catch in where it's important for you to do that.
Yes.
But for God's sake, don't sit on your tail when there's work to be done.
Correct.
Lee, how can folks reach you through organizations or otherwise?
I can be reached through Texas Death Penalty Abolition Movement. I can be reached through Texas, through TCADP, that Nancy just spoke about.
Uh-huh.
I'm easily found.
You're out there.
Yes.
And thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Ray.
Appreciate you being here. And Jim, can you take the microphone back here just a minute?
Sure.
How does a district attorney decide whether to go for a capital punishment case? Now, let's take Harris County out of it, because we're all familiar with Harris County, and they seem to look for every opportunity. But how is this done in other counties? Because other counties are not so busy at this as we are.
Theoretically, what most of them claim they're doing are having committees that they have several people that agree before they discuss it with the committee. It's usually a group committee that makes the decision. And a lot of it, I think, is probably politically motivated in some of the smaller counties especially. But theoretically, what most of them are doing are having a committee, a group of lawyers that get together and kind of hash whether they should or should not do it. And I think what's been a major impact is the new life without parole. I think that's changed a lot of minds. Because the commissioner's courts in a lot of these counties have gotten pretty angry because it costs a whole bunch of money to pay for death penalty cases, because a death penalty trial, when you pay the lawyer, is pretty expensive. And there have been a lot of pressure from commissioner's court to seek what they call death without waiving the capital case and waiving the death penalty, get an automatic life. And that's what they're doing in lots of cases now. And I think a lot of it's economically driven, especially in smaller counties.
What about these guys that say, well, my God, it's going to cost more to feed them than it is to execute them, so why don't we just go ahead and get it over with?
It's never been true, because when you start paying for the amount of paper that's filed in a death penalty case would probably feed a hungry nation. When they kill enough trees. No, it's always been pretty well true that the cost of trying a death penalty case and the cost of paying for all the appeals by far exceeds the amount it would take to house somebody for life. And that's always been pretty well typically true. And a lot of this, a lot of commissioners in these smaller counties, when they're kind of poor, lean on the DAs not to seek the death penalty, because they don't want to pay the expense of having a long, drawn-out trial. They have to pay the lawyer and pay for all the appeals. And a lot of it's economic-driven. And Harris County, one reason, they've always been pretty rich. And that's one reason they never backed off from trying so many death penalty cases. Plus, we've had that kind of inbreeding in the DA's office where bad perpetuates bad. And then what happens, the judiciary in Harris County basically is a retirement program for the DA's office. You never have any new blood in, because most of the guys sitting on the bench the day before were prosecuting. And it's kind of, and this is a sad thing to have to admit, the bottom feeders of the legal profession sit on the bench. They're the people who could make a living doing anything, but perhaps being a janitor if they were lucky. Give you a good example. Judge named Mansfield was on our court of criminal appeals, got elected because his name was Mansfield. When he lost his job, the only job he could find was getting a job as security guard, and got fired from it. And I'm serious. If you fired every judge at the Harris County Courthouse, they could not make a living outside a court appointment. Nobody would hire them. And that's the sad part, to have to admit that, especially in Harris County, our judiciary is basically an extension of the DA's office.
I've got a good friend named Alan Bernstein who's writing articles this week.
Good. I know Alan.
How desperate some incumbent judges are trying to find enough votes to stay.
You know why? They would starve to death if they have. Look at Jim Barr. Jim Barr was a little bit pipsqueak, hotshot judge. Yeah. Got thrown off the bench. He's running around
tampering with
up
the ladies.
He's running around sucking up to court appointments because his wife's a judge. He couldn't make a living. Wouldn't hire him to try a traffic ticket. And yet he sat on our bench for a number of years and got paid with the county. I promise you, if he fired every judge, they couldn't form a law firm. Nobody would hire them.
Mm-hmm. That's Jim Skelton, and he speak plainly.
Well,
in your profession, you do. Is that a ponytail? You speak more plainly if you got a ponytail?
Well, they know. The truth of the matter is they actually know I'm telling the truth. I know those people. They know good and well what I'm talking about.
Nobody knows. Let me tell you, you great unwashed people out there. If somebody in your family gets arrested, you don't know what to do. I mean, they're in jail. So the first thing you do, you got to go find a bondsman to get them out of jail. So you get to meet those charming people that make bail bonds. And they say, how much money you got here? And you tell them, and that's exactly what it takes to get them out of jail. Then you wake up the next morning, and you've got to have a lawyer. And you don't know the difference between a lawyer in a clown suit, and that happens, and a clown in a lawyer suit, and that also happens. So you don't know how to sort that out. And picking a good lawyer with no previous experience, so what do? You open your mailbox, and there are all these lawyers advertising that land in your lap when you do that. Well, this must be a good lawyer because he knows about my case already. And so you jump to that conclusion, and then they find out how much you're liable to make over the next 10 years. And they want all of it, plus your house and your car and everything else. And you don't know whether you're getting good representation or not.
Well, right. In Joseph's case, there was a lawyer disbarred.
In Joseph's case?
Yes.
The original trial lawyer got disbarred?
Yes.
Okay. That happens all the time. We are coming to the end of this show. And all of a sudden, we've gotten jovial again. The show was about Larry Davis, who was executed. Larry seemed to work at his disadvantages in the wrong way. He didn't have a family like you and I and many other people do. So he tried to make one out of the tough guys he found in prison. And they weren't very tough at all. He was with a couple of them when this incident happened, and the toughest of them all got 50 years, and Larry tonight got executed. And the state of Texas took full advantage of every aspect of the case. And tonight they went through a ritual activity that is as steeped in tradition and history as the killing of live sacrifices on the altar in the Aztec temples. They recorded when he got up. They recorded if he broke wind. They recorded what he had for breakfast. They recorded what he requested for a last meal. They recorded whether or not he ate all of it. They carried him into a room and they strapped him down, and two technicians tried to find a vein, and they put chemicals in his body and killed him. He is now dead. And they're going to go through this ritual a couple of times in the next week. And we will be here. My name is Ray Hill. The program is called Texas Execution Watch.